This class is about Vinaya and which is Buddhist ethics, the study of ethics. And you can't really study that, or the reason to study that is nirvana. It's because you want to reach nirvana. So really, the very first thought you should have in this class, I mean, the reason you came to this class should be because you want to reach nirvana. I was in a Buddhist class recently and I asked people what nirvana was and I got like 50 different answers. So I think first you have to decide what is nirvana. Because you're not supposed to be in this class unless you really want to get to nirvana. So first you have to understand nirvana. Nirvana is escaping from samsara. So to understand nirvana, you have to understand samsara. Nirvana is the escape from samsara. So you have to decide what is samsara. Samsara is pretty tricky. You know, you say escaping from samsara and people have this vision of some kind of a place. Like they think of this world. Or they, you know, they think maybe if you reach nirvana, you go to some kind of heaven or something. Or some people think that if you reach nirvana, you're just sitting there in a lotus position and your mind is reached some quiet place or something, or whatever. Samsara, escaping samsara is something different than that. Samsara, starting with this, our own body, okay? Your own body is part of samsara, okay? Your own body is part of what you escape. This body was caused by something impure. The reason it's the way it is because it was caused by something impure, and we'll talk about it sometime. But basically, this body is not very nice. I mean, sooner or later, this body will die. And it doesn't, in Buddhism we say it doesn't necessarily take a car hitting you. If you took this body and took it to the Museum of Natural History and put it on a chair, and they came and fed it every day and gave it something to drink and gave it vitamins and massaged it and exercised it and only organic foods, right? And if everything was absolutely perfect, you know, which never happens in real life, but suppose you got exactly the right exercise, exactly the amount of sleep that you need, no stress, someone's feeding you, only organic foods, best vitamins, best things to drink, you never smoked, nothing. If you put that body in that museum, and don't allow any cars or any bombs or anything near it, it would still kill itself. You know, that's the nature of the body. The organs inside the body are competing. The heart, the lungs, the liver, the kidneys, according to Tibetan medicine, are actually in conflict. They are competing with each other. And sooner or later, one of them gets weaker. One of them begins to assert itself. And they break down. One of them breaks down. And they stop. One of them stops. And it kills you. So the body itself, the kind of body that you and I have now, is doomed. And there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, once you're in it, you're stuck with it. And you can't fix things. You can try to do maintenance in a very intelligent way. You know, and some people succeed and some don't. But you basically can't save it. It is made of something impure. Its nature is impure. Sooner or later, it will kill itself. You can just be sitting there and it will kill itself. And that's one part of samsara. The other part is mental. And the first Panchen Lama describes it very nicely in his Lamrim text. And these are all the mental sufferings that people have. You can start with, and we've talked about it before, to me, the one that hurts the most is that a human mind cannot be satisfied. In its present format, in the present condition of our minds, they cannot be satisfied. A human mind cannot be satisfied. You work for what you want. You try to get things that you want. About, I don't know what percent of the time, you get them. So, but when you get them, it takes about a day or a week or a month, and then the mind starts to become dissatisfied with it. Like Clinton was very happy to become governor of Arkansas or whatever. Was it Arkansas? I don't know. But he was very satisfied. Like for the first week, I can tell you, he was probably thrilled. But then at some point, he starts to be dissatisfied. He has to be president, you know. work very, very hard, and get to be president. Then you finish your first term, then where you want, second term. I mean, the human mind cannot be satisfied. The human mind gets what it wants, sometimes, and then it cannot be happy with that or contented. It's part of our nature. Our nature is like that. It's one of our sufferings. And this suffering is inescapable. It's not like something that only happens in Bosnia or something that only happens in the third world or something like that. Everybody on earth, unless you're practicing very well, has this disease. And that's part of our minds. That's samsara too. That's a big chunk of samsara. Another kind of samsara is another kind of mental, which is that you can't trust anything in samsara. There's no normal object in this life that you can trust. You don't know that the job you have, you will have next week. You don't know that the spouse you have, you will have next week. You don't know that the health you share now will be gone next week. You can't say anything with certainty about your life. You just don't know. You can't tell me whether or not you will own the shirt on your back tomorrow. You can't say with certainty that that will be something that you own. You can't be sure that the place you stay you will have a week from now. You can't even be sure that the body you're in, you will enjoy its use tomorrow. You can't be sure. Nothing is sure in life. I mean, life is very chaotic, and nothing is trustable. You can't trust anything in life. From basic things, also relationships. Like, you can't predict how a relationship will go. You can't trust it. Its nature, the very nature, is to change. It must change. It will change. The people that you love today, you feel neutral about them, or you will hate them a year from now. The people that you could care less about could go either way. The people that you hate now can sometimes become your friends. There's absolutely no certainty that any of those objects stays the way it is. And it's a big suffering. You know, we suffer from that all day long. You have basic things that you take for granted, like being alive, or being healthy, or having a good mind. And they could all disappear tomorrow. None of them is anything you can count on. Nothing. And this is a suffering that's related to our mind. The mind tends to perceive things due to certain causes. And as those causes change or wear out, the nice things that we own, or even the nice things that we are, has to go, must change. Every part of your life is fluid, and it's all shaky, and it could all change tomorrow. And there's nothing you can do about it. It's going to be that way. You can't say that any of the relationships you have today will not be totally different several weeks from now. You have no guarantee at all. Nothing. And this is samsara. This is the nature of samsara. This is the nature of the human mind and the human body. Our bodies and our minds are defective. And it can't turn out right. You know, you can struggle your whole life to get something nice place to stay. You can struggle your whole life to find someone that you get along with, and someone you can love, and then someone you can be with. And you can struggle all your life to find some kind of security, and you just won't find it. It doesn't exist. You know, you might as well give up now. I mean, you can, if you didn't notice yet, that's the way it is, you know. And if you're kind of young and things are still going okay, you can keep trying, but it just gets worse. You know, there is no certainty about anything. Even your mind, you can't control the state your mind will be in a week from now. You cannot control it. This is suffering. All this change and all this uncertainty is suffering. And we have it, and it's part of our nature. So escaping from samsara is escaping from that part of our own nature. Okay? Escaping from samsara is to escape from that part of our own nature. You don't have to move out of New York. You know, it's not New York City, it's not America. It's that condition that your relationships are not predictable, your life is not predictable, your death is unpredictable, your health is unpredictable, your own mind drives you to be unhappy, and you You can't stop it. This is the nature of the mind. This is the nature of samsaric mind. So nirvana is to escape that. When you get to nirvana, it's like here. The definition of nirvana in Tibetan is Nyendrib Malupa Bangbe Soso Tango, and it means the permanent stopping of your bad thoughts. According to Buddhism, samsara is created ultimately by bad thoughts. Anger, desire, jealousy, hatred. Ultimately, that condition that I described, that your mind is constantly shifting, that your relationships must degenerate, that your own body must collapse, all of this is caused ultimately by bad thoughts. And why and how, we'll cover. Okay, it can be proved. But take it for that way right now. Nirvana is a place that you reach where you just don't have those bad thoughts anymore. You just don't have them. You are not capable of them. No matter how badly someone treats you, no matter how nasty a thing someone says to you, no matter what kind of disaster happens in your personal life, your mind is in a place, it's like some golden window. You know, it's like some porthole. And inside there, it's just totally golden light, totally free and incapable of having a bad thought. Someone can attack you, someone can say something to you, someone can physically abuse you, and you might have pain, but your mind cannot be disturbed from that peace. And sometimes nirvana is called peace. Peace is a synonym for nirvana in Tibetan, Shiva. So nirvana is reaching that mental place where you are incapable of having a bad thought ever again. Soso tango. Nyendrib Malupa Bangbe Soso tango. Soso tango means you can only reach that condition by soso tak. Soso tak comes about here. It's the this is emptiness, okay? This is direct perception. And somewhere along here, somewhere between samsara and nirvana, you must perceive emptiness directly. You must. Okay? It's part of the definition of nirvana. Nirvana is the permanent stopping of your bad thoughts due to having seen emptiness directly. Due to this experience. This must take place somewhere in here. Okay? Must take place. Sometimes this is called wisdom, and we have three trainings in Buddhism. Wisdom is number three. We call it, the Tibetan here is shiram, and it's basically the direct perception of emptiness. Okay? Emptiness can be perceived intellectually, which takes a lot of training, but not so difficult. The direct perception of emptiness in deep state of meditation is much more difficult and much more rare. Extremely rare. The essence of the extraordinary training of wisdom is to see emptiness directly. The scriptures state, especially in the Abhidharma, that to reach that perception of emptiness directly, your mind must be at a certain meditational level called Sanden Dambu Nyendo. Micho me. We'll call it, say, Tingen Zin. By the way, I'll say Tibetan. You don't have to memorize it. If you're in the Tibetan track, you have to memorize it. But I just think it's good for you. Most of the English course from the last year has now transmigrated to the Tibetan track. So the point is, if I keep saying Tibetan words, sooner or later you'll get comfortable with it and you'll move to the Tibetan track. Okay. It's a very easy language, not hard. Okay, say Tingen Zin. Tingen Zin. Tingen Zin means that extraordinary training of meditation is called Tingen Zin, Lapa Tingen Zin Lapa, which means basically the ability to keep your mind on one object, fixedly, fixated on one object. Okay, that's also possessed. That ability is also possessed by baseball players. Businessmen like my boss. The object in the first case is the baseball. Like if you see the guy at bat and they close up on his face, and as the pitcher releases the ball, the eyes start to dilate. You know, you actually see the pupils dilate. And the guy, if he's a good hitter, he's actually got Tingen Zin towards the baseball. And that's, it's not, you don't have to be a Buddhist. It doesn't have to be a holy object. You can have meditative concentration standing there in a baseball game. He doesn't hear the crowd. You know, he doesn't taste the tobacco. You know, he doesn't smell the catcher. You know, his mind is totally fixated on the ball, if he's good. And the eyes are dilating and he's got singing in. To differentiate meditation on the holy object from normal meditative ability or concentrating ability, we say extraordinary. Extraordinary means Buddhist, you know, fixated on a holy object. Okay? And that's why the three trainings are called extraordinary. They're actually called the Pakpe Labasum, which means extraordinary trainings. What's that? We're going to talk about it. Okay? I'm going backwards. Okay? extraordinary training of meditation is like you can think about it as a pond, and that the water is totally still. The top of the surface of the water is totally, perfectly still. Perfectly quiet. And there's no ripples and there's nothing moving. That's perfect meditation. That's Tingen Zingi Lapa. Number one, I'll put it up here. Say Tsuchim. You gotta make noise in a language. It's not a language class. You gotta make noise, okay? Tsuchim. Tsuchim. Okay, good. It'll start to get in your stick in your mind, and after a while you'll be learning Tibetan. So just warning you. Alright. Tsuchim is sometimes translated as morality. I like to call it ethical living because the word morality, you know, brings up images of Billy Graham screaming at you and the Christian Coalition and all that, you know. It's just an ethical lifestyle. It's a good, being a good person in your everyday life. That's tsuchim, okay? This training is described as being like the quality of that pond that is very pure. The water is very pure. So if you had a big pond of water and the water was very, very pure, that's an ethical way of life. If the surface of the water was perfectly quiet and had no ripples or disturbances on it, that's the extraordinary training of meditation. So where does wisdom come in? They say that if the object called emptiness is going to reflect on that thing called the surface of your mind, the mind must be totally pure and totally quiet. Okay? You cannot see emptiness. It's totally impossible to see emptiness unless you reach the first level of the form realm, of a whole different realm. Your mind has to reach a meditative level which is out of this world. Okay? It's out of this desire realm. It's such a perfect meditation that your mind, as you see emptiness directly, must be in the first Samdhan level, the first Samadhi level. Must be. Okay? Otherwise, you cannot see emptiness directly. Reaching that level takes a certain amount of training, like jogging or weightlifting. You know, if you wanted to lift a certain weight, you would have to do a certain kind of regimen every day. And to reach that level of meditation takes maybe an hour a day. You must meditate at least an hour a day to reach that level of concentration. In addition, your conscience must be perfectly clear. And that's the rub. That's the hard part. Okay? People constantly coming to me, I've been meditating for 6 years and nothing happened. And then I say, well, the first question really is, are you doing the preliminaries properly? There are certain warm-ups to a meditation session that if you don't do them properly, the meditation will never go very well. There's like 7 steps to get into deep meditation. But more importantly, there's a relationship between these three trainings. Meditation depends on an ethical way of life. If your conscience is not clean and clear, happily clear, you will not be able to meditate perfectly. It just won't come. It will never happen. And that's just the fact of meditation. The presence of something unclean in your life and knowing it and being aware of it will prevent you from reaching a deep state of meditation. You just can't. So in Buddhism, an ethical way of life, it's more important than just being a good person for the sake of that. To reach the higher goals, to reach nirvana, you have to see emptiness directly. You must. To see emptiness directly, you must have this level of meditation. You must reach this level of meditation. You cannot do that without having an ethical way of life. And it's compared to the reflection of the moon in the pond. You know, if the pond water is going like this, the reflection will go like that, and you'll never see emptiness. Emptiness is such a subtle object, it cannot reflect in your mind stream unless that mind stream is perfectly still. And that's meditation. It can't be still unless it's pure. The water has to be pure. Your mind, your heart has to be clear of any bad deeds. You know, so you have to clean up your life for that reason. You will never see emptiness if you can't. And if you can't do that, you'll never reach nirvana. Impossible. It's part of the definition of nirvana. You can't do it. So you can see that training number one leads to training number two. Number two depends on number one. That fact is not talked about much in America or at all. I mean, they don't say when you go to, you know, this temple and you're going to meditate, they check you at the door and say, did you do anything bad this morning? You know, because your meditation's not going to work. I mean, people don't do that. And Jetsun Kapa, in the poem you're going to read, there's a poem, a letter that he wrote to one of his most beloved disciples. It's your reading for this first class. And in that letter, he says, back in 1400, when he wrote that letter, he says, people even nowadays, they don't realize the connection between one and two. He says, everybody has forgotten it. He says, people do understand the connection between three and two. You know, people understand that if you can't get into perfect meditation, you'll never see emptiness. He says, people understand it like barely. This is back in 1400 in Tibet. But he says, people who understand that you have to be living a good life to reach that state of meditation, he says, everybody forgot it. He says, nobody remembers that. Back in 1402 or whenever he wrote this letter, it's like, you can read that in his letter. He says, people don't understand the connection between living a good life and being able to meditate properly. Living a good life is, what is a good life? You know, I mean, different people have different ideas. Different religions teach mainly the same thing, but with some differences. In Buddhism, we say that to really understand the rules of a good life, you know, what should you do and what should you not do? You know, what's a good thing to do and what's a bad thing to do? You must study Buddhist scripture. Okay? You must study the word of an enlightened being. Why? Because the connection between what you do now and what comes to you much later because of those actions is so subtle that only a Buddha can perceive it perfectly. They say colors like red and shapes like round or square are on this level of reality. And everybody can perceive them pretty easily, except for blind people or whatever. And on the second level is emptiness. And only a select few people in the world have seen that directly. Maybe fewer. And then on the third level is the real subtle connection between the good and bad things you do and what happens to you a year later. You know, why is the air conditioner not working quite perfectly? Why is it a bit noisy, but it's still cooling us? You know, why do I have this mixture of goodness and badness? I mean, only a Buddha can tell you, oh, back on October 3rd, 1966, remember? You were cooling off this thing, but you quit because you wanted to go eat, and that's why. I mean, we don't have that capacity. So the Buddha taught 16 volumes, 16,000 pages about ethical living. You know, how do you live an ethical life? And that's the all of the Buddhist teachings. We have about 1,000 texts in the Kangyur. The Kangyur is the speech of enlightened beings translated from Sanskrit into Tibetan. So we still have about 1,000 separate works. The shortest one, do you know? Heart Sutra? There's a book called Om. And it's one syllable. It says Om. That's the shortest book in the Kangyur. The longest one is like 100,000 verses or something. You know, it covers many volumes. But basically, a huge part and the first part of the Buddhist canon, of the whole Buddhist scriptures, is called the Vinaya. Okay, say Dulwa.
Dulwa.
You guys are sleepy. Dulwa?
Dulwa.
Dulwa?
Dulwa.
Okay, Dulwa is the Tibetan name for Vinaya. Okay, that's the first huge collection of Buddhist scripture. And in that collection of scripture, the Buddha describes what it would be like to lead an ethical way of life. Oftentimes he does so by describing stories of the past where somebody did something wrong and got some horrible result from it for thousands of years. And most often, the bad guy is the Buddha in his former lives. Okay, it's very, you know, when you read it, it makes you goosebumps because he'll go through this describing this bad boy, for example, who beat his mother on the head, and then he'll describe incredible, fantastic adventures that the boy went through and incredible things that he saw, extraordinary things that happened to him. And then at the end, he'll give the punchline and he'll say, and that was me. You know, and most often the stories are actually from his own life. And he's describing how not to live an ethical life by describing his own mistakes, most often. So there you get 16 volumes of that, or something around that. Then you have the extraordinary training of meditation, and that's treated in, say, Do. Do. Do is a Tibetan word for sutra. Sutra has three different meanings. Okay, and you should know. First meaning is the difference between sutra and tantra. Okay, sutra meaning the teachings of an enlightened being which are not secret, and tantra meaning the teachings of an enlightened being which are secret. Okay, so all the Buddhist speech, everything the Buddha ever taught, can be divided into sutra and tantra. That's not what it means here. Okay? Sometimes sutra means a short book, and the word do means short book. That's also not what it means here. Okay, the third meaning is one of the three great collections of Buddhist scripture, one of the three pitakas, and that's what it is here. So don't get confused. Okay, this sutra means that huge collection of Buddhist scriptures spoken by the Buddha, which talk about how to reach meditation, how to reach perfect meditation. Okay? And for wisdom, which used to be up here on the board, it's called the Abhidhamma basket. There's a section of Buddhist philosophy called Abhidhamma. This is not that. This is a whole group of scriptures that treat wisdom, collectively are known as Abhidhamma. The order of the scriptures in the Kangyur, the order of all the scriptures that the Buddha ever taught, is exactly this. First come the Vinaya scriptures, then come the Sutra collection, and then comes the Abhidharma collection. This is the order of the Buddhist canon. And Jetsun Kapa says, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that it corresponds to the order of the three trainings. You have to start with the Vinaya collection of scriptures because your spiritual practice has to begin with an ethical way of life. Your whole spiritual life, everything you're going to do spiritually, has to start with Vinaya, has to start with living a good life. Based on that foundation, you can move up to the Sutra collection of scriptures, which is the next part of the canon, because that teaches perfect concentration. And you cannot have perfect concentration, meditative concentration, Buddhist concentration, if you have something on your conscience. Can't do it. And you can't, and the third basket or the third great collection of scripture is Abhidharma. It comes third because it relates to the training of wisdom. And you can't get that unless you have perfect meditation. As a basket it's called Lumba, which is just Abhi. Tsongkhapa is reacting to a corruption of Buddhism during his time. You know, during his time and before his time, there were people in Tibet who got a smattering of Buddhist philosophy from a few Indian teachers that showed up in Tibet. And then they heard about Tantra, and Tantra sounded like a lot more fun. And they started doing Tantra. And then after a while, the whole thing got so corrupt that you had people saying something like, I just want to see emptiness or do secret practices, and I don't need the first pitaka. You know, once you see emptiness directly, you're freed from this very boring thing called ethics. You know, you don't need ethics if you've reached that high level called wisdom or meditation or especially tantra. There were people in Tibet saying that. And Jetsun Kapa came back with, you know, why do you think the Buddha spent 16,000 pages describing an ethical way of life? You know, was he stupid? Or he didn't know that it wasn't necessary? Or he didn't see emptiness? Or he wasn't practicing tantra? Or what do you think? You know, I mean, he's trying to prove that not only is an ethical way of life related to emptiness, you can't reach emptiness unless you are ethical. Impossible. Totally impossible. So he's saying that people who say it's not necessary or not related are crazy. And he was very adamant about it. And then he went through describing the relation of the three baskets. So we're going to start with Vinaya. We're going to talk about Dulwa. Okay. Dulwa is a word in Tibetan that means to tame something or to control something. It's the word in Tibetan that's used for what you do to a crazy horse. Like when you're breaking a horse, that's called dulwa. Dulwa means trying to control a wild horse. That's dulwa. Okay. A dulja, which means the wild horse to be tamed, is the Tibetan word for a disciple. A student in Tibetan is called dulja. Okay. Dulja means somebody who has to be dulwa. And dulwa means to control or discipline or train. To bring a wild horse under control. And that's the literal meaning of dulwa. This is a very famous quotation by a lama called Luchadhammabhadra, who's very important in the lineage of Vajrayogini, who is one of the main predecessors of Pabongka Rinpoche, who was our teacher's teacher, who was Rinpoche's teacher. He said this about the meaning of dulwa. So I'm not going to, you don't have to write the whole thing out, but I'll just say it, because it's a blessing to say it. Say dulwe, denu, ki, juja, pongdun, korche, ki. This is supposed to be like this. Nyomong, pa, dulwa, dang, wangbo, dulwa, chebechir, dulwa. Okay. Dulwe denu, this part here, it means the basket of Vinaya. All those books about the Vinaya. Okay. All those books about leading an ethical way of life. Kijaja means its subject matter. Its subject matter. The subject matter of the scriptures on Vinaya. Okay. What is the subject matter of the scriptures on Vinaya? Pongdun. Say Pongdun. Pongdun refers to, Pong means rules, Dun means seven, number seven, okay, seven rules. How many bad deeds are there if you group, Abhidharma says, Ragrum Chena, Migawachu. There's 84,000 different variations of bad deeds and bad thoughts. But if you're going to make it easy for American disciples in 1996, what's the minimum number you could talk about? 10. Basically 10. Okay? I mean, the 10 non-virtues. Okay? You know them. We'll go through them really fast. It never hurts. First one? Killing. Okay, killing any living creature. Okay. Second one? Stealing anything of value, like more than 10 cents or a dollar or whatever. Okay? Third one? Sexual misconduct, which mainly refers to adultery, but not only. Okay, three that you do with your body. Okay, three bad deeds that you do with your body. Okay, those are the three of body. Then there are four of speech. First one being lying. Good. I like this. You know, I was teaching a Buddhist class to a bunch of old timers in this. I won't say the place, and nobody could name the 10 non-virtues. I was like, yeah. First one is lying. Okay. Creating a misimpression in someone else's mind. If you define it that way, which is the way they define it, it becomes a lot more subtle. Second one? Yeah, divisive talk. If it's in the top 10, we must be doing it all day long. So it doesn't have to be, you know, some secret plot to split up two friends. It can be those very subtle slips of the tongue where you slightly put someone down in front of someone else, and as a result, they slightly get alienated from them. And we do that all day long. All day long, we are constantly dropping hints that so-and-so is not as cool as I am, and you should probably not like them as much as you do, and you should like me more. I mean, that's the basic format. You have variations, but that's the basic format, and we do it all day long. Number three of speech, harsh words. And all of the scriptures are very careful to say it does not have to be a curse word. It could be, hi, how are you? You know, said in the right way and knowing that the other person's feeling will be hurt. Okay, fourth one, idle talk. Okay, just, you know, they used to say gossiping, but you don't have to be gossiping over the fence with the other person. We do it all day long. Any kind of talk which is not relevant or necessary is idle talk. The ultimate form of it is saying your prayers without thinking about them. Seriously. Okay? Ultimate form of idle talk. Last three are of mind. The last three you do in your mind, what are they? First one is craving. You know, craving other people's things. And it makes you unhappy all day long. You know, I had it a couple times today at work. You know, it doesn't, you could crave other people's possessions. It's the coveting that's mentioned in the Ten Commandments. You can also crave their personal qualities. And that's where jealousy comes in. So all of that is under number 8. How about number 9? Ill will. Ill will means number 9. That means like not being too upset when something bad happens to somebody else. And we do this constantly. You know, even when it's destructive to ourselves, even when there's bad results for ourselves, we are never that sad when someone else screws up. Never as sad as we are when we mess up. You know, and there's this kind of very sick, subtle pleasure that you sometimes take when you see somebody at work mess up, and you're like, oh, stupid them, you know. It's very subtle, and if it's in the top 10 out of 84,000, you know, if it's more important than 83,990 others, it means we're doing it almost all day long. Number 10, wrong views, classic 2, not believing in past and future lives. And then, second one? Or thinking that the idea of karma is stupid. Okay, do you do that? I mean, when was the last time you gave a speech about the stupidity of karma? You haven't done it recently. But if you did any kind of bad thing today, from the slightest irritation at someone, then implicitly you have that wrong view. Because you are saying, that's not going to have any result on me. It will not boomerang back to me. You know, you didn't say, you didn't have a very slight irritated thought towards someone and then sit down on your chair at work and say, oh my God, I just created a huge bad karma. You know, it's going to come back to me. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. You didn't do it because you really don't believe in it. you know, it sounds good theoretically, but it's not enough to keep you from killing roaches or anything like that. You know. We have it. And every time you do even the slightest bad deed, which can be very subtle, it takes about a second to think an irritated thought about someone, it is a bad karma. And you're spitting on the rules of karma. You know, you're spitting on the laws of karma. You're saying, I don't believe you. You know, if you don't stop and say, oh my gosh, you know, what I just do? I just planted a seed which must come back to me. You know, I mean, if you really understood Buddhist psychology well, you would be terrorized at your own mind. And every time, you probably couldn't make it through the day if you really believed in karma. If you really understood karma clearly, it'd be very hard to get through a day with our minds in our present condition. So, Pong Dun, why does it say only 7? Vinaya mostly relates to the first 7. Okay, Vinaya mostly focuses upon most of the vows in Vinaya are focusing on what you do with your body and what you say with your mouth. They are not focusing so much on what you do with your mind. Okay, that's left mostly to the Bodhisattva vows and to the secret vows, which we're not covering in this course. Okay, we're working on Vinaya. So the main subject matter of the Vinaya is keeping those 7 korche. Korche means along with their friends. Kor means retinue, Okay, the retinue, like the Dalai Lama's core, is all his bodyguards and all the people, his managers and all the people who take care of him, and cooks and people who carry his robes for him, and all those people are core. So core chain means along with your great circle of supporters. And that's where you get the other 83,999. They're all in there. Okay? Core chain is very tricky here. Core chain means and all the other bad things you could do. Okay? Ki nyomong ba? Say nyomong. Nyomong. Nyomong in Sanskrit is klesha. It comes from the root klish. And klish means to bug somebody, to bother someone, to afflict someone, to interrupt someone, to upset somebody. They're all klish is that meaning. So klesha or nyomomba means mental affliction. Okay, mental affliction. Defined as semishuachepesemchum, which means any thought that disturbs your peace of mind. Okay. There's tiny kleshas, tiny bad thoughts, like a moment of irritation, and for as long as that stays with you, you can't really be happy. It's like throwing a rock in a pool of water, and there's those ripples that go out. And then you get really angry, it's like throwing a boulder in a pool of water, and there's this huge splash, and the mind is like this for about 3 hours or something. You know, and then it slowly comes down like that. That's the function of a klesha. That's the function of a mental affliction. Its function is to ruin your peace of mind, commensurate to the strength of the klesha. And it can ruin your peace of mind for 10 years. I mean, I've met people like that who are obsessed by something that someone said to them or some incident that happened in their life. And they're holding that klesha for that long. That's a mental affliction. When you get rid of that permanently by seeing emptiness directly, you've reached nirvana. That's the definition of nirvana. I mean, you can reach nirvana tonight and you won't look different to us. You know, you wouldn't have the frowns or the grimaces that we have. No, you just wouldn't be capable of it. There would be no thought behind the skin to express itself that way. It's very interesting. You would never go like, you know, or, you know, you couldn't do it because you just don't have those thoughts that would drive your mouth to do that or your forehead to do that. I mean, so your face might change slightly. But otherwise, the rest would be the same. You're stuck with the body until it wears out, until it dies. In extraordinary circumstances, with extraordinary teachings, which are secret, even that can change. But that's a long story. And it's secret. Dulwa. Dulwa means to what? Tame. So here, Dharmabhadra, who lived about 200 years ago, is explaining the word dulwa. He says, the Vinaya is called the Vinaya. Dulwa is called dulwa. Because if you take the subject of the Vinaya scriptures and apply it to your own mind, and if you're able to keep the morality of avoiding those seven bad deeds and their nasty friends, well then, you can dulwa your bad thoughts. If you dulwa your bad thoughts, then you've reached nirvana. So that's the first reason why Vinaya is called Vinaya. Dulwa is called dulwa because it can, you can dulwa your bad thoughts, meaning control, tame, discipline, stop, like a wild horse. Okay? And dung, wangbo. Wangbo means the sense organs. Okay? Migme, naome, name, cheme, lume, sume. Those are the, in the Heart Sutra, these are the sense organs. The eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the sense of touch. As long as you are closely obsessed with those organs, you know, as long as they are a large part of your life, that you're struggling to see the things you want to see. You know, you want to live in a part of New York where you don't see certain things, you know, and you turn on the best CDs, and you wear only the best perfume, and you only go to the best restaurants, and you only wear very pleasant clothes, and you exercise just right, then you're living in the world of the senses, and it will cause you to suffer. You cannot satisfy those demands. And the more you try, the worse it gets. The more you need them and the more you want them. It's a trap. If you study Vinaya, you can dulwalchepa those sense powers. You can bring them under control. You can start to move out of that sphere of activity of the sense organs and move more into a spiritual sphere. Okay? It doesn't mean you can't eat. You have to eat. It doesn't mean you can't listen to nice music. If it comes, listen to it. But don't get caught up in it. And the better you keep your vows, the less you will need that gratification. And the happier you'll be. Because you can't gratify yourself on will. It comes to you, you can't control it. You can't demand that music sound good tonight. Sooner or later it won't sound good. Sooner or later you'll die, you won't be able to hear it anyway. You know, you can't control those things. You cannot control sense objects. Period. And you get very frustrated trying, as you may have noticed. Okay? So the second benefit of dulwa, of vinaya, the second function of dulwa is to dulwa your sense organs. To bring them under some kind of restraint and push you into a different sphere, a higher sphere, spiritual sphere of life. Chir means because of that, we call the vinaya dulwa. And there he has the word dulwa again. So Dharmabhadra is telling you why vinaya is called vinaya. Dulwa, meaning discipline, is called dulwa because you discipline or you turn off the mental afflictions and you discipline your sense powers. Okay? And that's why vinaya is called vinaya. One more point and then we'll take a break. In the monastery when you're about, I mean if classically you'd enter it at 7 years old or something. And the first thing they do is they sit you down and they make you memorize the Abhisamma Ankara. It's about 50 pages long. And you have no idea what it means, not one word. But your teacher says, okay, you got to memorize the Abhisamma Ankara. This is a work by Maitreya, the future Buddha. So it's this blessing, even at 7 years old, of having the words of Maitreya in your mind and in your heart. And it starts to echo through your mind all the time, and then it starts to have an effect on your mind stream. And then when you reach about 13, 14, you start to study what it means. Okay. So I encourage you, if you're going to take this class, you know, write down this pronunciation and memorize it. And it's a little piece of sutra. Okay. It's a little piece of the Buddha, as you'll soon see. All right. Memorize it. Doesn't hurt. You know, it might bounce around in your head and do something. Say dulwa, ni, dendang, dumba, lu, yin. Dulwa ni, dendang, dumba, lu, yin. Okay. Dulwa means what? Vinaya. Okay. Discipline. I call it Buddhist discipline. You can call it vowed morality if you want. It does not have to be monks and nuns. Okay. As you're going to see, just about half of the vows relate to lay people. By the way, I'm not allowed to teach you the Vinaya which relates to monks and nuns' vows. Those are secret, and I cannot teach them to you unless you take ordination. So, if someone says, what are you studying over there at 6th Street, you have to say Vinaya. But, he's only teaching us the part that doesn't relate to monks and nuns' vows. Otherwise, I get in trouble, okay? And I'm not going to teach you the monks and nuns. I can't. Until you become ordained, and then I will. Okay, then we have to. So, dulwa ni, vinaya is, ni means is, ten. Ten means the teachings of the Buddha. Okay, this quotation is by the Buddha, and in this quotation the Buddha himself says, if all you had in your house was the vinaya scriptures, not the whole teachings, but just the vinaya scriptures, that's enough to say, in my house, I have the whole Buddhist teachings. He says the Vinaya scriptures themselves, just the teachings on leading an ethical life, represent the entire teachings of the Buddha. I mean, we have a project going in Russia. We're cataloging the scriptures that are in that particular library. It's going to take 10 years. There's 200,000 titles there. Probably there's more. I mean, definitely there's more. But if you took those whole hundreds of thousands of scriptures and you put them all into one, it would be the Vinaya. He says, the Buddha himself said, if you got the Vinaya, you got the Buddhist teachings. Okay? Then, dung means and, dumba. Tenpa means the teacher, capital T, which means what? Lord Buddha, okay? And this is another thing that he's saying. He's saying, if you've got the Vinaya scriptures, and if you study them, then you can say that I'm alive in the world. If there's anybody in the world studying Vinaya, you can say that I'm in that room. And he doesn't mean it metaphorically. He says, Mu means the actual, the real thing. You know, very interesting. You know, the Buddha is saying that if there's a person in 1996 in the East Village studying Vinaya there properly, I am there. And that is my teachings. Those are the total teachings of the Buddha. You know, he was very adamant about it. And he said to the monks many times, you know, if you're wearing those robes, you're representing me. You know, so be careful. You know, as long as there's one decent monk walking around on the planet Earth, I'm there. You know, that represents me. I am that. And when you study the kayas of the Buddha, the bodies of the Buddha, you'll see why it's true more. But basically, yin means is. So what the Buddha is saying in this quotation is that so long as anyone in the world is truly studying Vinaya, and that Vinaya is teaching that person how to behave ethically, I'm there. That's me. That is the Buddha. The Buddha exists in the world. The Buddha is walking on planet Earth as long as somebody in Sixth Street is studying Vinaya. Okay. We'll take like a 10-minute break and then come back when you hear there's a little gong. Okay. So now we go to the boring part, the more boring part. Okay. In the monastery, you know, they just throw you into Vinaya class and they hit you with all these things right away and they don't tell you the history of Vinaya. And you don't hear much about, you know, where did it all come from. I thought you might like to see the lineage. You know, so we're going to do very briefly, you know, where did it all come from. Say, Gelongpai, Sotargi, Do. Gelongpai, Sotargi, Do. Okay. Gelongpa means a fully ordained monk. Okay. A full monk. And later we'll get into all the kinds of monks and things like that. Okay. But that's a fully ordained monk. Sotar means vowed morality. Okay. And we'll talk more about it. Literally, it means a vow of individual liberation, a vow of freedom. A vow of freedom. Sotar. Okay, freedom vows. And we'll talk about why they're called freedom vows. You can probably guess. Whoa. Do means sutra. Sutra. This is the ultimate source of the Vinaya. These two are the two root texts. Gelong Mai Sotaki Do, you can see there's only one difference here. Mai means what? It's feminine. It's the feminine ending. So Gelong Mai Sotaki Do means the sutra on the vows of individual freedom for a fully ordained nun. And that's a Gelong Ma. These are the two root sutras. They're called the root sutras, these two. All the Vinaya teachings in this world trace back to these two sutras, spoken by the Buddha. There are also four different explanatory sutras. Okay, they're called the four explanatory sutras. And I'm not going to go through their names with you here, but there is a set of four sutras which explain the two root sutras, and they're called the four explanatory sutras. So if you look at what's in the canon about Vinaya, these are the two root sutras, then there's four explanatory sutras, and then there's a whole bunch of what we call relevant sutras. Okay? They're like Vinaya-related sutras, which are not included here. So there's huge... The materials are huge. I mean, we've put a lot of them in on the computer. It's thousands and thousands of pages. Yeah, this one means the sutra, do, ki of, sotar, individual freedom vows, of a fully ordained monk. And this is the sutra of individual freedom vows for a fully ordained nun. And those are the two root sutras. I'm only going to ask you on the homework about the two root sutras, so... Don't worry. Then in the Tengyur, which is the classical commentaries on the sutras, the Tengyur and the Kangyur are two divisions of what in Tibet are called the Buddhist canon, and The Kangyur is spoken, has to be spoken by an enlightened being. Those are the teachings of an enlightened being, either this Buddha or another Buddha. There are 1,000 books. There are like 3,500 books in the Tengyur. Tengyur is the early Indian commentaries. Okay, and the most famous one is called Dulwe Do. Say Dulwe? Do. Dulwe Do. In Sanskrit, just for your information, it's the Vinaya Sutra. Very famous. It was written by, say, Lopan, Yenden, Wu. Lopan, Yenden, Wu. Okay. Lopan means Acharya. It means a master, the master. We're not supposed to, in Buddhism, ever refer to our teachers lightly. So we always say master before that. Master, Acharya. Yenden, in Sanskrit, is Guna, and Wu is Prabha. So his name was Guna Prabha. You can say Master Guna Prabha. We're not sure when he lived. We take a guess that it was around 500 AD. And he wrote the Vinaya Sutra. But didn't I say at the beginning of the class that a sutra is a book written by, spoken by a Buddha? So what happened? Did Yenden become a Buddha? This is a trick, and it messed me up for years, but I finally figured it out. This sutra means short book. It doesn't mean a sutra. Okay. In this case, the word sutra means a short book. And in this book, he has managed to stuff in the entire contents of the four explanatory sutras, those four sutras on Vinaya. Those are hundreds and hundreds of pages long. Yenden Wu took a whole thing and squished it into a sutra, meaning a short book, and he named that the Vinaya Sutra. In the next class, we're going to go through an outline of the whole thing. So in a nutshell, you'll be able to see the structure of the entire Vinaya. It's very exciting. It's very rarely been done. He took the entire huge teachings on Vinaya, squished them into this little book called the Vinaya Sutra, and we're going to go through the whole thing. I mean, just the whole topics next class. Okay. Last thing tonight is I wanted you to know the names of the three books we're going to be studying. There's this famous story of this American young hippie who went to India to learn Buddhism and was in a Tibetan class in 1973 or something, and went to the train station to go to Delhi for some visa thing, and there was this big hustle and bustle, and there were all these attendants coming in and out of this room in the railway station. And so we asked, you know, who's in there? And they said, the senior tutor of His Holiness. So we ran and bought these lousy little Indian cakes. And, you know, the train is coming, right? And we ran into the room and we wanted to offer them to him. And the head of the Tibetan library was standing behind him. And we prostrated and, you know, like we knew like 20 words of Tibetan. And he says, what are you studying now, dear? And we were studying Shanti Devas Bodhicharitara, but we didn't know how to say it. And we didn't know the name of the book we were studying. And the library director was standing behind him going, Bodhicharitara. Because he was getting embarrassed, you know. The moral of the story is you should know the name of the book you're studying. Okay. I'm going to give them to you in order. And then that's the last thing tonight. You don't have to put this on your homework, but I just thought, you know, it's good to have that seed in your mind. Okay? I'll write it first. Say, Dulwa, Gyatso, Ningbo. Dulwa, Gyatso, Ningbo. Dulwa means Vinaya, yeah, Buddhist discipline. That you gotta know, okay? I mean, if the Dalai Lama's friend shows up or something, he says, what are you studying? Dulwa. Oh. Okay. Gyatso means what? Tenzin Gyatso is His Holiness's name. Ocean, okay. In Mongolian?
Yeah.
No, what? Gyatso is Tibetan. What about in Mongolian? No. What's the Mongolian? Tala. That's the Tala and Dalai Lama. Okay. Dalai Lama means Gyatso Lama. So Gyatso is Tibetan for ocean. Ningbo means the very essence. Okay, the very essence. So this is a book called The Essence of the Ocean of Vinaya. And the story is that the author of this book took those huge four commentaries, the explanatory sutras, and took the very essence out of them. He's giving you the very essence in a few pages. Okay, who would do something like that? He's always doing things like that. Okay, first he writes the 1,000-page commentary, and then for normal people, he writes a 3-4-page one. Okay, and that was by Jetsun Kapa. And his I like you to know his years. This is a summary of the entire contents of the Vinaya in about 3 pages, 4 pages. Okay, it's extraordinary, and it's wonderful, and etc. And you're going to study the whole thing. We have located a commentary on it. You know, we're in different countries looking for what's left of the Tibetan Buddhist scriptures. And in many countries, we're searching to find the ones that were destroyed in Tibet. And we found this one. And it's very beautiful. Short name. Say Nyinje.
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 Nyin means day, and Je means to make. So what is Nyinje? Nyin means daytime, and Je means make. So Nyinje is... It's called day maker, and it means the sun. It's a poetic word for sun. And it means that if you open this book and study it, you will be like shedding sunlight on the true meaning of this book. Okay. I mean, it'll be bright as day. If you open this book and study it, then it'll be like turning on a huge torch, you know, spotlight on this book, and you'll understand what it means. It expands on Tsongkhapa's text. That's by, and it's just good to know and to appreciate all the trouble these lamas went through. So you should learn his name. Master Muchu Dhammabhadra. His name was Sanskrit, but he's a Tibetan. He was one of the few Tibetan lamas who was given a Sanskrit name. Muchu means quicksilver. And it's significant in Tibetan because it's traditionally in alchemy, this was the main ingredient. This lama has the ability to turn iron into gold. Something like, I mean, philosophically speaking. Or maybe really. I don't know. But he wrote this commentary. His dates are... He is one of the most important lamas of the Vajrayogini lineage. His commentary was the basis of Pavongka's commentary, which is the basis of most study of this lineage in this world right now. And very incredible lama. And there's one more commentary we'll be using... And that's the end of the class. Say Yishin,
Yishin
Norbu.
Norbu.
Yishin,
Yishin
Norbu.
Norbu.
Yishin Norbu. Norbu means a jewel. Norbu means a jewel. Yishin means a wish fulfilling. Wish fulfilling jewel. This is the Aladdin's lamp of Asia. Okay. There's supposed to be this jewel that if you find it in a swamp and dig it out and wash it with these special perfumes and treat it with a special cloth, and then you put it up on the top of a victory banner, and then you make offerings to it, there comes this transformation of this jewel. And then anything you can wish for, you get. You know, you just think about the jewel and you make a wish and then you have it. That's called a Yishin Norbu. This is the name of an important commentary on the Vinaya. Okay. It's also the name of... It's the Tibetan name for His Holiness. The Tibetans don't call the Dalai Lama Dalai Lama. They call him Yishin Norbu. Okay? And it's sort of an affectionate name. I mean, all over India and Tibet, people refer to His Holiness as Yishin Norbu. They don't say Dalai Lama. Okay. It's a beautiful word. The author, say Chone Lama Dapa Shedup. Chone Lama Dapa Shedup. His dates are... Most of the major monasteries in Tibet, the Gelugpa monasteries, there are 6 major colleges, 2 each of the 3 major monasteries. Each college had its own textbook series. In Seremeye, which is the greatest monastery in Tibet, we had 2 sets of textbooks. And the second set was written by Chone Dapa Shedup. He's from Amdo. Chone Lama means the Lama from Chone, which is a section in Amdo, which is East Tibet. And the Amdo writers had this extraordinary ability to explain things much as a Westerner, like a Western scientist would. They were very precise, very... they went through the subject very methodically, and they asked all the questions that you or I would ask. So his works are especially wonderful to study. They have been missing for 40 years. All the copies were contained in the library of Serame, which was bombarded by Chinese artillery in March of 59 and totally burned. So we've been looking for over 35 years for a copy. It's 12 volumes, and we found one in St. Petersburg in the collection there. So you'll be the first people ever to study this commentary in modern times. That's 140 pages long, and it's extraordinary. It's a beautiful commentary. So we're going to study parts of that commentary as well. Serame is trying to reprint it right now, but we have copies here, so you guys will be studying it. That's about it. I think just try to keep in mind the motivation, you know. It's sometimes easy to collect Buddhist knowledge without collecting Buddhist realizations. And, you know, try to think of Vinaya in the way that Tsongkhapa mentions it. When you read the reading, it's a very, very beautiful letter that Jet Tsongkhapa wrote. He had two famous disciples who are up there, Gyaltsebje and Kedupje. Gyaltsebje on his right-hand man, and Kedupje. And you never hear about his other great disciples. One was the first Dalai Lama, Gendun Drup, and one was Ngawang Dakpa. Ngawang Dakpa trained with Jet Tsongkhapa. Jet Tsongkhapa trained him thoroughly. Then he took him in a room and said, "I'm sending you to East Tibet, and I want you to make 100 monasteries and ordain a bunch of monks, and then you can come back." So he sent him to, like, nowhere. He sent him to Gyelrong. Gyelrong, we have a deep connection with Gyelrong because our root lama, Ken Rinpoche, came from Gyelrong House. Pabongka Rinpoche came from Gyelrong House. You are all unofficially members of Gyelrong House. This is a small college inside of Serame. So he sent him out to Gyelrong, which is the very border of China. And he said, "Go found 100 monasteries." And he actually did it. But he was very lonely out there. He missed Tsongkhapa a lot. And he kept sending Jet Tsongkhapa love letters. And they're very beautiful. They're very touching. And Jet Tsongkhapa kept sending him these wonderful letters full of advice. One of them is the Three Principal Paths, which is probably one of the most famous Tibetan commentaries ever written. It's actually part of a letter that Tsongkhapa wrote to this guy that he banished out to East Tibet. One day, Ngawang Dakpa was able to ordain the first monks in that province. And he was very happy and very proud, and he sent Jet Tsongkhapa a letter. And then Jet Tsongkhapa, out of joy, wrote an explanation of why ethical way of life is necessary to reach nirvana, why you must have a pure conscience to get perfect meditation and then to see emptiness directly. So he wrote this beautiful poem about it, and that poem is in your reading. That's the first time it's ever been translated, I think. So enjoy it, and try to get the spirit of Vinaya. You know, get pumped up for your study from that poem. It's very beautiful, and it comes from his heart. When you read it, it's like the end is very, very touching. You know, he's saying, if you study Vinaya perfectly and then see emptiness and reach nirvana and then later reach Buddhahood, then you and I can enter paradise on the same day, and we'll share the cup of immortality together. It's very, really beautiful. So, you know, try to read that and try to get pumped up for it. Okay, we'll do a short meditation, like just for 3-4 minutes. I know it's hard at the end of class because you will invariably think of the bus you have to catch or something. But try to think, try to be happy about the class. It's a great opportunity. I don't think Vinaya is taught at all in this country that I'm aware of, very little. And you're very select, you know, you're very special. It's a very special chance to study something holy. So be happy about it, think about it, and then we'll do some prayers. Who's the chanting master in this class? Anyway, you want to try, Vilma?
Yeah.
Okay, so when I make the sign, you start the ending prayers. The ending prayers are in your book also. We'll do the mandala offering, and then we'll do the loa, which is a dedication. Okay, so but first we'll do a little meditation.